This is Anthony Iannarino, and you're listening to In the Arena. So you love the social tools, so you want to use the social tools because you believe they make selling easier? Maybe you're right. I think the social tools work, but they're infinitely more effective in the hands of someone with all of the attributes necessary for success in the first place. And these attributes, for my money, are more important than the actual tool set itself. But that said, we do now have the tools, and if you aren't using them as part of your sales game, especially to nurture relationships with buyers as they travel through their buying cycle, you're making an enormous mistake. Jill Rowley was with Eloqua. They were just purchased by Oracle, and her new role is in evangelizing the social tools. For my money, she's a perfect demonstration of somebody who has a blend of the ability to use these social tools with all the other attributes that lead to success generally in sales. I talked to Jill about the early days of Salesforce.com, succeeding in sales before there were social tools, the value of curiosity and business acumen, and how to stand out and connect in this social world. Welcome, Jill Rowley, into the arena. Hey, Jill, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Anthony?
I'm wonderful. Thanks so much for being here.
Happy to be here.
I want to ask you four questions. I'm going to start with one right out of the gate on social selling. You are an extremely visible advocate for social selling, and I am too. A lot of people think of me as a social guy, although I don't think of myself in those terms. But I've watched you now, and I've read about you. We've had a couple conversations. I believe that you were successful in sales long before social tools were available, just from our conversations. Am I right about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually started my first sales job was about 13 years ago, and I joined Salesforce.com when they were under 100 employees. And I actually had a tough time getting the job because I didn't have any quota carrying, bag carrying experience.
What were you doing before that?
I was in consulting for 6 years. So it was litigation support consulting. I did a lot of spreadsheet analysis. I did some financial models. I liquidated an insurance company. I adjudicated reinsurance claims. So I had a lot of different kinds of experiences. I audited insurance companies to ensure that they were prepared for Y2K. So I had a lot of different kinds of business issues and challenges that my projects had me solve, but I never, quote, carried a bag.
And then did you succeed right out of the gate with Salesforce.com?
I was successful right away.
What do you attribute that to? It wasn't social tools.
No, this was actually really pre-email almost. I mean, email was just becoming a popular channel. I mean, email was used for back and forth communication, but not as a campaign tool. And I think I have a natural curiosity and a natural thirst for learning about businesses. You know, anytime I walk into a restaurant, I'm actually doing the calculation in my head. How many tables do they have? How many times do they turn the tables? What's the average order if someone consumes alcohol versus doesn't consume alcohol? You know, is it better that they get the person to buy dessert, or is it better to turn the table to get a bigger check the next time? So I'm just always constantly thinking in business terms. I went to undergraduate business school at UVA. And so I just was naturally curious and thirsty and hungry to understand the company that was going to become hopefully my customer. And not just the company and what the company was doing, but the industry that the company was in. And also then the people with whom I would be communicating our value proposition. So although I do talk a lot, in my sales situations, I really do try to, I've got two ears, so I should listen twice as much as I talk. Asking good questions is something I've always been pretty good at.
This isn't going to be a great interview, though, if I do all the talking. So this is working out fine. So I heard you say two things there, though, and two things that I think are really important. Curiosity. And I think that that's something that's underrated as an attribute for salespeople. I think just being generally curious about other businesses is a great asset and a great attribute for a salesperson. And the second thing I think your consultant's background gave you was business acumen. So you look at business not as a salesperson, but as a business person. So you're looking to get that deep understanding. And what I heard you say, there's a great lesson here for people that are listening to this. You looked at the business and then you look at what's the industry that they're sitting in, what's the environment that they're sitting in. And I think that's a consultant's background. But if you're listening to this and you're a salesperson and you want to know how do I become a better salesperson, two great keys right there with just generally being curious and interested in other people's businesses and then understanding how business works. And that sounds like it worked for you right out of the gate.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that I knew beginning was the water cooler effect and really saying, if I'm going to get this company and this person within the company to agree to change, I need to make it as easy for her as possible. And the way that I can make it easy for her is to get everyone who surrounds the decision talking about the business issues that can be solved from my software. For example, Salesforce.com, in the beginning days, it was more SFA, Salesforce automation, than customer service, than marketing. So it was really about pipeline and opportunity management and having better visibility into where deals are in the sales cycle and the average number of days in each stage, measuring your conversion rates. And, you know, back then, a lot of sales leaders were doing that via spreadsheets. And every Friday, every rep around the world would have to send in their updated spreadsheets. And so you just didn't have real-time information on how to manage the business. Everybody in the company cares about revenue. And so if I could get the water cooler effect, where usually it was the sales ops person or maybe the VP of sales or a regional manager who was coming to me with looking for a solution, if I could get the CFO and the CEO and everybody else in the company thinking about forecasting accuracy and pipeline management, it's going to be a lot easier for that sales ops person to get the budget to make the purchase of my product. So that water cooler effect was a strategy, not just being single threaded with the guy who made the inbound call for information. So I knew that instinctively that the decision would be made by influence from other folks. And I tried to communicate with those other folks, even though maybe the sales ops person didn't want me going around him.
Sure. And consensus, I mean, we're more and more seeing clients make even small decisions by consensus. Let me move you to another topic that's near and dear to your heart. So I believe salespeople are now charged with also being marketers. And
yes,
and we now have the tools available to help salespeople become marketers. But what I see some sales organizations do is to put everything that I would call a nurture tool, anything with real insights, behind a wall. They want the buyers to enter their email address on a website so they can capture the lead, and then they blast the client with marketing messages. And I believe salespeople need a nurture toolkit that they have some greater control over. They need tools that they can send directly, adding a personal note explaining why they believe the insight that they're sending the buyer is relevant to that buyer at that particular time based on something that they know. And I think this is part of, when we talk about the disconnect between sales and marketing, I think this is part of it. So first off, you're free to disagree with me here. You can share your thoughts because you know more about some aspects of this than I'll ever know. But if you could share your thoughts and then maybe just answer the question, how do we arm the sales force with the tools that they can more easily and effectively use? And I'll give you one other thought on this. If I get something from a company and it's branded and it's an email that came to me from marketing without a rep being attached to it, it's spam. But if I get something from Jill and it's got a personal note, Anthony, I remembered you were reading this book and this made me think of you, and I think this idea would help your business, then it's very different for me.
Absolutely. Well, first, I agree with you that salespeople are becoming more like marketers. And I think it is buyers. It's all based on the fact that the buying behavior has changed and the buyers are buying differently. They're going to the web and they're getting self-informed. They're doing research on their own before they actually want to engage with a salesperson. And buyers are consuming information in their social networks. So if a sales rep can get into the social networks of their future buyers and be sharing compelling, relevant content in those social networks, so that those future buyers are now consuming the content that the rep, the sales rep who usually only wants to talk about, you know, when are you going to buy? Do you have budget? Do you have authority? What's your time frame? You know, the rep traditionally operating in more of a BANT, budget, authority, need, time frame world. Now, if the rep can become connected, relate to, and engage with buyers when they're in that earlier phase of education, then the rep now is creating a personal brand of being someone very knowledgeable about the business problems that the buyer has.
I call them a value creator.
It's
somebody that has the ability that when I look at them, I say, I know this person can probably help me with my challenge.
Exactly. And for me, I'll answer the nurture question. Let me answer that one first. When I was a rep at Salesforce, I had my first territory at Salesforce was the whole country of Canada. And we didn't have Canadian pricing. We didn't have really any demand generation happening in Canada. But who was I to complain? I was a brand new rep with no sales experience, and I had a whole country, for Pete's sake, when other people only had like three states. So there was this little company that I really wasn't supposed to spend much time with because the license revenue was tiny. They had 10 employees. It was a little company called Eloqua. And I got to know the founders, Steve Woods in particular, and they were looking to forge a partnership with Salesforce.com. And in my natural curiosity of what do you do as a business, and oh, wow, that technology sounds really cool. I'd love to use it. I started to do, back then, manual lead nurturing. And what I did is there was a counter across from my desk, and the counter had printed article reprints from CIO Magazine, from Wall Street Journal, from Business Week. It had some marketing produced customer case studies. So I had all this content that was printed and that I would go over and I would assemble couple pieces of content and grab a hat or a Salesforce.com t-shirt and stuff it in the envelope. And I would send it to the guy who I was engaged with. So the sales ops guy or the VP of sales, whomever was driving the evaluation. But that was one package, one person, and I had no visibility. So I said, what if I take those article reprints and I create email templates? And then what if I string together a series of emails over a 3, 4, 5 week period of time? And in the in the sequence that I think the buyer needs to get educated around what is Salesforce automation, what is software as a service, who is Salesforce.com, who are our similar customers. And I manually remind myself, I sent email number one, and not just to the sales ops guy. Remember the water cooler effect? So I would go to the internet and I would find out who else worked at that company. This is pre-LinkedIn. So this was, I could pretty much only get who the management team was, not all of the employees.
And probably only for big companies.
Exactly. And well, I mean, there were smaller companies would have management team bio pages or press releases where you could find a name of someone in the press release. So what I would do is I would then start to build my database of people within that company. And then even back then, if I sent an email and I got an out of office and the out of office had three other people listed, if you have issues with compensation, call Brian. If you have issues with CRM, call Mark. So I would take those names from the out of office response, add them to my CRM database, and then start to manually send email communications to these additional people to create the water cooler effect. And the beauty of these emails was that I could make them pretty. There could be graphics. And I would create the template, so I would just reuse them all the time, and they were trackable. So what it would tell me, Eloqua would give me back who opened the email, how many times, was it forwarded, did they click on any of the links? So I, way back then, was nurturing contacts with visibility into response. If someone responded, I would call them versus calling the, you know, 20 people who hadn't responded to that my email communication.
That was animated Jill actually picking up a handset while we're talking.
Oh, yeah. I got to have my props. I definitely have to have my props.
So you developed your own nurture toolkit.
Absolutely.
And then you used Eloqua before they poached you from Salesforce.com to manage the effect of that so you could visibly see it and then know how to take the next action.
Yeah, and Eloqua, Salesforce hadn't purchased licenses to Eloqua at that time. That was ultimately the end goal, is to get, you know, Salesforce to buy licenses of Eloqua.
Did you buy license on your own to use that?
They gave it to me.
Okay, cool.
They knew they needed a strong champion. And I still have the BlackBerry, the original BlackBerry. I got to get it for you. I still have the original BlackBerry that I bought with my money that has an email on it from Mark Benioff telling me to get every sales rep at Salesforce using Eloqua. And I say that was an email that he sent in December. It was a promo campaign that we were running around Christmas time, end of year. And I sent the promo email to Mark Benioff from the Eloqua system. And he said, get every salesperson using it. And when I closed the deal with Salesforce.com, when they became an Eloqua customer on August 17th, 2011, that was 3,321 days in the pipeline. My company found a replica of this BlackBerry that I still have with Mark Benioff's email because I persevered. I never gave up on my dream of getting Salesforce to use Eloqua.
How many days was that?
3,321 days in the pipeline.
Boy, you don't give up.
Never give up. If you know you have something that is of value, that company needs to run their business better, never give up.
Great advice. Let me move you through another question. This is sort of the same thing. I'm just super skeptical of claims that buyers are 57% through the buying process because of the internet and social media. I know that's true for B2C because of the way that I make purchases. I won't go anywhere until I've looked at whatever it is I'm going to buy before I make a move. But in B2B sales, I think there's another reason people are so deep. A lot of the clients that we call on have already bought what we sell. So they already know people. They already know and understand their needs. They've been out. They're being called on all the time. They know who the potential partners are in a lot of cases. So I think they're not out doing as much research as it were made to believe, because they don't have to. All they have to do is wait about 4 more minutes and somebody's going to call them or shoot them an email with information. Everybody's on the social web now. We're all sharing ideas. We're all sharing insights. Everybody's bought in, or let's pretend everybody's bought in. I know there are some laggards. So I'm a sales rep now. How do I use the social web to stand out in a messy, cluttered social world?
Yeah. It's so much easier than you would think. And I'm actually, quote, retiring my bag after 13 years in software sales, almost 11 of those I've spent at Eloqua. Many, many years been the number one rep. And even in 2011, I won Employee of the Year award. But I'm retiring my bag to join Oracle's global sales enablement team to head up our social selling enablement initiative. And it's all about teaching the sales professionals how to be modern sales professionals, how to, instead of selling, how to help people buy, and how to get in that earlier conversation where that buyer is on the web, is in his social networks, doing that early stage research and standing out as someone who can help the buyer make the right decision, implement the software the right way, get the right people with the right skill set on her team to be successful. And so the social channels, it's so much easier than you would think. It takes work and it also takes change in your behavior. And that's the hardest thing for anybody in the world, is to change their behavior and to make it a pattern and a process and a routine. So what I do is I use these social networks to, one, find the buyer. Find who within ABC company would be beneficiary of my technology. So marketing automation, clearly I need to talk to marketing. Marketing operations, if they have it, because marketing ops usually owns the technology infrastructure. Sales, because sales is going to get higher quality leads that are scored and nurtured before they're passed to sales. LinkedIn, essentially. Started following him on Twitter. He was tweeting about the 49ers during the Super Bowl, so I know he's a big 49ers fan. So I use the social web to find the right people, to be able to relate to them on a personal level, to connect with them, and then to engage them.
Here's what I hear you saying, though. So you're using the social web, and it's not a matter of standing out and saying, look at me, and drawing attention. It's a matter of, how do I get enough insight to develop a one-to-one personal relationship and a connection so that when I do engage, I've got real insight and real knowledge and a real ability to make that connection stick?
The human element of the process.
Yeah.
The saying was people buy from people they like. I think the trust factor is more important today than the likability. And so people are buying from people they trust, and they're being influenced by people they trust. And usually the people they trust are in their social networks. So if I look at Jonathan Becker, CMO of SAP, and I say, who is Jonathan following on Twitter? I go follow those people. and I start to retweet what those people are tweeting about, I become more relevant to Jonathan Becker because I look more like him. I'm reading the same things that he's reading. I'm sharing across the social web similar things that he's sharing. And I'm not doing it in a...
It's not tactical.
It's not fake either.
Right.
It's not fake. You know what? Mm-mm. I don't have time for lies. I don't have a good memory. So, and then you joked earlier that I take notes. I always take notes in every conversation I have because I don't have a good memory. And so if I write it and I read it, the information sticks with me longer. And so I'm not going to tweet or comment or share or favorite something that I don't actually like. But I'm sure usually I can find something that I can relate to.
And I had to tease you about the notes because they're on paper. And I mean, that it wasn't that you're a note taker. It's that you're using, you know, this centuries old technology to do it. I'm just teasing you.
You know what? I have a drawer full of my notebooks. I have every notebook I've ever used from the beginning of my sales career. Every single notebook.
I've given up paper and I hate it. And then I got on a plane and I had a great idea. And I was just at an event with Chris Brogan and he gave me a Human Business Works little notepad. And I had the notepad in my bag and I was so happy to actually have paper. Because during that first 10,000 feet, you can't turn on your iPad. So fortunately, I didn't lose two really good ideas because I had that old school paper. Let me ask you one more question. Again, it's a long one. I'm sorry. So I think our clients' communication preferences are changing. And I still believe that they use the phone. I still think the phone's good. I have a client right now that prefers text messages to all other forms of communication. And I couldn't understand why, because he's 49 or 50 years old. And for him to choose text, it just seems unnatural to me. So I pressed him as to how he developed this, adoration for text because he loves it. And he didn't know. And I said, finally, you have teenage children, don't you? And he said, yeah, I have two teenage kids. And I said, they trained you to use text, didn't they? And he said, yeah, they did. So he loves it. It forces people to be concise so he can give people a short answer to the question they need and he can move on. My 15-year-old son doesn't watch television with the exception of The Walking Dead. And I have, he's all YouTube now. And I have twin daughters, 13 years old. And they left Facebook for Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Last week, they deleted their Facebook accounts and they told me it was for old people. So I don't know what that means, but what do you think this means? Because we're going to have people right now that are growing up. They're going to be our clients of the future. And they're growing up with very different ideas about communication than we have. And we have an older generation of salespeople, old people like in their early 30s,
who grew up
with some of this. But they're going to need to be able to communicate with a future generation that looks at email as, I mean, they don't look at email the way that you or I look at email as an effective communication tool. They look at it as a complete burden and a waste of time. And you're going to text me if you want me. And that seems to be changing. And in marketing and thinking about that future generation of customers, what do you think we're going to be dealing with there?
Yeah. So I refer to that as the millennial generation, right? And I think the text... Yes, because he has teenagers and that's the method of communication that he's had to adopt that channel. It is more concise and usually faster response because you're not writing a big, long, dissertation talking about every single feature or function in your software and boring the crap out of the reader with all of that information. The millennials, if you think about digitally native versus you and I are digital immigrants.
Right.
We didn't grow up with computers and the internet and social and apps. We didn't grow up with any of that. We've had to teach ourselves how to use those channels that weren't native to us. My 8-year-old daughter, Lily Kate, we went to the Rose Bowl. My husband's Stanford alum, my husband's father's Stanford alum. They both played golf there. And so Stanford was in the Rose Bowl, and we went, and Stanford won. And we road tripped instead of flying. It was 6 of us in the SUV road tripping down to Southern California. We win the Rose Bowl, and I'm too cheap to buy the champion t-shirt on campus because I think you can get it on the web for cheaper. So we get, you know, back, and Lily Kate has her iPad, and she wants to buy her sister a Rose Bowl t-shirt for Valentine's Day. She just goes on her iPad, does a Google search, finds the Football Fanatics site, picks the shirt she wants, asks me what size, and then says, "Mom, can I use your credit card? I've got cash from my allowance. Can I use your credit card to buy this?" And that's just she's 8. She thinks in terms of web, digital, real time, fast, and it, we are going to have to keep up.
Their expectation is going to be very different in the way of communication. It's got to be instantaneous. You've got to make it easy for me to do. If I can't do it, there's something wrong with you, not with me, because I should be able to, like, you've got an 8-year-old, but I've seen 3-year-olds figure out an iPad in just a few minutes with the swiping. And I've got a buddy who called me laughing because his daughter was walking up to the TV set, putting her hand on the screen and trying to swipe the picture away, which I know is coming. But In her mind, it's like a big iPad. But I do think that they're going to expect instantaneous response. They're going to expect answers to their questions to be instantaneous, if not faster. And I think Absolutely. That's the generation of salespeople and buyers that we're going to be dealing with. Let me stop this here because we've gone a long time. But I want to ask you, first I want to say thank you for being here. But I want to ask you if you'll come back and if we can do another one of these where you and I just talk about what you call the water cooler effect, but I call it building consensus and how you did that.
Absolutely. I'd be delighted to come back. And this has been fun for me. So thanks for the invite to be in the arena.
Thank you. So that's Jill. She is, in my mind, a pure, unadulterated hustler. And you can see why she's successful. Follow her at Jill_Rowley on Twitter or reach out and follow her at LinkedIn. You can find me at thesalesblog.com. And when you get there, make sure you sign up for the newsletter so you can get my best thinking every Sunday morning in your inbox. And that's this week's show. I'll see you next week in the arena.